This public radio podcast is supported by Constellation Energy, a global provider of fuels, power, and energy services, committed to environmentally sound, energy efficient, and sustainable energy solutions. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When monthly retail numbers come out, especially when they're not that great, we hear all kinds of excuses. The weather was bad, so people didn't want to drive to the mall. Peasant skirts just aren't that flattering, so women stayed away. Well, one major retailer is giving up on the monthly excuses and trying to buy itself some extra time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working to help reduce greenhouse gases with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. And by Grant Thornton, serving their audit, tax, and advisory clients worldwide with people who love what they do. Online at grantthornton.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. He's in Dubai preparing for our broadcast from the Middle East next week. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday. It is the 6th day of March. The prognosis just improved for consumer spending, which is the lifeblood of the U.S. economy. The world's biggest retailer, Walmart, gave us a look at its latest medical chart today. Sales increased a healthy 2.5% last month. Even Target, which has been suffering from anemic sales lately, took a turn for the better with a slightly better than expected 0.5% improvement. But one major chart is missing from the monthly retail checkup. As of now, Macy's has decided it wants a little privacy from the usual investor poking and prodding. More on that from our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
No news may be good news when it comes to avoiding the embarrassing headlines after a lousy sales month.
Management doesn't want to get beaten up once a month when these numbers aren't coming in the way they want them to.
Marek Fuchs is a commentator for TheStreet.com. He contends there's no other plausible explanation for Macy's to suddenly stop issuing its monthly results. Chief Financial Officer Karen Hogay dropped the announcement in during a conference call with analysts last month, but few media outlets noticed.
Is trying to cut back on the information that we're providing to investors. That is not the intent.
Macy's blames undue confusion over calendar shifts and seasonal promotions. Frank Badillo, senior economist at the research firm Retail Forward, says the big department store chain has a point.
Every Easter, when there's a shift in the Easter holiday, for example, or when you have fewer shopping days after Thanksgiving in any given year, it can make these numbers a lot more difficult to interpret.
But TheStreet.com's Marek Fuchs says that doesn't justify a public company telling investors they can't be trusted to do that.
Every savvy investor knows to take any single month with a grain of salt and to look at variables, certainly. But the point is, companies always choose bad times, times where things are turning against them, to change their practices in terms of reporting. And it's always a red flag.
Fuchs says the withholding of information mainly leaves smaller investors in the dark, and he says just at the wrong time. Macy's joins a growing list of companies that have stopped providing monthly numbers, including Home Depot and the parent firm of Sears and Kmart. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Here is a sadly familiar headline. Foreclosures hit an all-time high in the fourth quarter of last year. That's according to the Mortgage Bankers Association. And more homeowners are falling behind on their monthly payments. One of the accusations that surfaced fairly early in the subprime crisis is that predatory lenders targeted minorities for the riskiest and most expensive home loans. Today, the Illinois Attorney General issued subpoenas to Countrywide and Wells Fargo as part of an investigation into pricing disparities. And a new report shows accusations of predatory lending during the housing boom might have merit. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more.
The report looked at the portfolios of 35 subprime lenders that were active in 2006, but went bankrupt or were sold in 2007. It studied 7 urban markets, including New York, LA, and Cleveland. And it found that high-risk loans made up 20% of all loans in predominantly minority communities, compared with just 4% in mostly white areas.
When we look at the data, it does seem that race is a larger factor than income.
That's Kevin Stein with the California Reinvestment Coalition, one of 6 community groups that contributed to the report. He says minority communities have long had trouble accessing credit through mainstream banks. That left room for predatory lenders to swoop in, make a killing, and leave.
So those guys are out of business, but guess what? Thousands upon thousands of their loans are still sitting in our communities, almost like a ticking time bomb waiting to go off in the form of foreclosure that has these larger ripple effects on the broader community.
Carlos Gutierrez is a mortgage broker in Minnesota who specializes in home loans to Hispanics. He says his clients can be susceptible to aggressive lending practices like low teaser rates or no down payments.
I know among the Hispanics, there's a huge amount of trust and loyalty that they place in people that they do business with. And some people do take advantage of that.
The report recommended new laws to protect homeowners and tenants from foreclosure. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
You might have heard about that memoir, Love and Consequences, the one written by Margaret Jones about growing up in a foster home in South Central Los Angeles. Only her name is actually Margaret Seltzer, and the memoir is actually a work of fiction. If all this sounds like old news, that's because it is. It wasn't that long ago that publishers recalled James Frey's fake memoir, A Million Little Pieces. We asked Stacey Vanek Smith to look into the price of publishing lies.
Book publisher Riverhead pulled 19,000 copies of Love and Consequences off store shelves just days after the book was released. Sarah Nelson is editor-in-chief at Publishers Weekly. She says it was an honorable and expensive decision.
They have the shipping both ways and the advance, you know, and all the salaries and time and printing costs. It's a couple of $100,000. You know, it's a significant amount in a publishing house.
This has happened several times in recent years. So why don't publishers just hire fact checkers? Publisher James Atlas says fact checkers have never been part of the $24 billion book business. The job is just too big and expensive, and the industry is shrinking. That leaves fact checking to editors. Problem is, publishing companies often pressure them to churn out a certain number of books every year. Atlas says costly mistakes like this could change that.
It undermines the industry's credibility. I just feel like eventually the price is going to be too high and greater efforts will be made.
But we might be holding the publishing industry to unfair standards, says literary agent Ted Weinstein.
This is essentially a product recall.
Weinstein points out that nearly 500,000 books were published in the last 3 years.
It's like saying that any time a tire has a blowout, we should alert the media. There are times where a product in any field is, there's been a problem with it.
Not everybody is losing money on Love and Consequences. Copies are available on eBay for as much as $100. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, a new low for 2008 on the S&P. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Zillow junkies beware. If you type in your address, you may not like what you find. Americans have seen the percentage of equity in their homes fall below 50% for the first time since the Second World War. That number out today from the Fed. Commentator and economist Glenn Hubbard says if we want to get serious about attacking the housing mess, we need to let the Federal Housing Authority do its job.
Congress quickly enacted a stimulus package that should offer modest, though needed, relief for the economy. But the plan will do little to address our pressing housing crisis. Most of the housing discussion in Washington is focused on how to avoid another subprime mess. Granted, the Fed needs to rethink some of its supervisory and regulatory procedures. But what can we do to solve today's problems? Congress should temporarily expand the Federal Housing Administration's authority in the near term. The FHA should be able to make larger loans to homeowners who live in their own homes. Why? Many creditworthy homeowners got trapped in adjustable-rate mortgages and couldn't refinance. Any borrower who can document their income and afford the mortgage without a reset should be able to refinance. With the FHA's new loans, they'll be able to. we need to get to the heart of the credit problem. These homeowners should not have to face foreclosure because they couldn't refinance an adjustable rate mortgage, especially one that was never intended to be long-term financing. This change will offer immediate relief to the housing market. Once these ARMs have been cleared out, refinanced, or sold, new loans can be re-underwritten properly. This would make sure that borrowers are fully capable of making payments, and security holders can get cash today for loans that were made to good borrowers. Bad loans can default promptly. Still more forceful actions may sound good, but beware the unintended consequences. Proposals to extend loans or halt foreclosures put us on a precarious path, because if we change the rules after the fact, we could chill new lending. A strong temporary government presence for homeowners, not a bailout of investors, will help delever the financial system. High leverage helped bring us this crisis, and moving homeowners to more stable mortgage financing will help end it. The temporary FHA expansion will increase taxpayer risk, but that risk looks better than the credit meltdown we're courting.
Glenn Hubbard is the dean of the business school at Columbia University. He used to run the Council of Economic Advisors for President Bush. Are you trapped in an adjustable rate mortgage? Tell us about it. Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. And a correction to an interview we aired yesterday regarding Walmart's charitable giving. It totaled just over 2% of the retail giant's net profits last year, not 0.02. Tomorrow night, a little piece of what used to be East Germany will disappear. The Berlin Polar Bears will play their last regular season ice hockey game in the former East Berlin's Sheet Metal Palace. They're leaving their shabby communist-era digs for new modern skybox-filled arena built by none other than Anschutz Entertainment Group. AEG owns, among other properties, the Home Depot Center and the Coliseum at Caesar's Palace. Some polar bear fans are worrying that American-style sports capitalism may kill off the team's spirit. From Berlin, Brett Neely reports.
It's Friday night, and the polar bears are mopping the ice with a rival team from the former West. 4,700 fans packed into Berlin's sold-out Sheet Metal Palace. Most of them are on their feet, body to body on concrete bleachers. The place looks like an airplane hangar and smells like an old locker room. But the beer is cheap. They're chanting, East Berlin, East Berlin. Even though Berlin has been reunited for 18 years, most of the fans still come from the East, and many of them still wear Dynamo's jerseys, a relic of the pre-unification days. Back then, the Polar Bears were half of the world's smallest ice hockey league, just two teams, with not much else to cheer for. East German hockey fans embrace the polar bears. Longtime sportscaster and former player Lothar Zoller explains.
About 30 fan clubs have formed around the polar bears, and that's how the spirit evolved.
That nostalgia hasn't been lost on Anschutz Entertainment Group. The American company bought the polar bears in 1999. It also owns ice hockey teams in Germany, Sweden, Great Britain, and the U.S., Anschutz has made the Polar Bears one of the most successful franchises in German ice hockey. So successful, they've outgrown the Sheet Metal Palace. When the new season begins in September, the Polar Bears will be facing off in the $200 million O2 Arena. O2, as in the giant European cell phone company. Goodbye, locker room stench. Hello, luxury boxes, expensive dinner club, rock concerts, and 14,000 seats. The arena is part of a huge entertainment complex going up close to where the wall came down.
We're going to have penthouse apartments with a sundown over the river views, and it's going to be a great part of Berlin.
That's Billy Flynn, the team's general manager for finance. The team wants to draw West Berliners, so ticket prices will stay the same, for now. But the number of standing benches, the cheap seats, will be cut by a third. Flynn insists Anschutz isn't trying to freeze out the team's core fans.
That will be part of the show, the atmosphere by the ice bear. We're world famous for that.
But the Polar Bears' working-class fans are worried their traditions will disappear. They want more standing room bleachers. They also want the communist-era dynamo banners to fly in the new arena. But fans are also realistic about what Anschutz has done for the polar bears. Matthias Tyler has been coming to games for about 6 years.
Without them, the success wouldn't have happened. My God, that's the way things are in sports today. Nothing happens without money. It's sad, actually.
Like most fans, Tyler plans to go to games in the new arena. But like many, he's worried the spirit of the old arena will ring hollow in the fancy new space. In Berlin, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Naomi Kresge contributed to our report. Coming up, laying the groundwork for a new West Bank.
We definitely don't build for today. I don't build under the assumption that the occupation will exist forever. We are putting in place the seeds that will grow post-conflict.
But first, let's do the numbers. News of a spike in foreclosures and troubles in the mortgage bond market sent stocks spinning today. The Dow lost almost 2%, 214 points, to close at 12,040. The Nasdaq dropped 2.3%, 52 points, to end at 2220. The S&P lost 2.1%, 27 points, to finish at 1305. That's the lowest the S&P has been for the year. Financials led the markets lower after two mortgage bond holders defaulted. Citigroup slid more than 4%. Goldman Sachs flopped 3.75%, and Ambac crumbled another 14%. Bonds traded up. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.58%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. Middle East reporting on Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. And by Cleveland Clinic, expanding globally and committed every day to providing innovative treatments and hope to patients worldwide. Online at clevelandclinic.org. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for February, and the topic of workplace bullying gets worked over at the International Conference on Occupational Stress and Health. Finally, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee examines compensation packages given to CEOs of corporations involved in the mortgage crisis. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal, who's on assignment in Dubai. Last night, the Boston Celtics clinched a spot in this year's playoffs. They're the first NBA team to do so. The team is profiting from both young talent like Rajon Rondo and veterans like Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce. Today's basketball stars arrived in the NBA not via a farm system like in Major League Baseball, but through a much more commercial system. Now the league and the NCAA are looking at new ways to prepare youngsters for the big time. Our Business of Sports commentator Diana Nyad is here. How are you doing, Diana?
I'm well, thanks.
Ready to talk some basketball?
Ready to go.
So what is the system right now in terms of development for young basketball players?
A few years ago, a guy named Sonny Vaccaro, he's kind of a character that Marlon Brando should have played in the movies, but he worked for Adidas. And now he has since worked for both Reebok and Nike. But he virtually was the one who started the sneaker summer camps. And it really became kind of a nice centralized place for now all these scouts, instead of going state by state by state all year round to observe the players, they just go to the big summer Adidas camp, or they go to the big summer Nike camp, and for 3 weeks, park himself, if he's, let's say, from Duke University, on a bench and watch all the kids who come in and who are being courted by the sneaker companies.
So what does this current plan look like, that the NBA and NCAA are looking at a possible partnership?
For 2 years now, they have been meeting, as you say, the NBA and the NCAA, about taking over and doing their own developmental programs. So they would set up, and they've gone down to Florida to observe the IMG tennis academies. So kids come from all over the world. They live there. They eat, drink tennis all day long. Well, now that's what the NCAA and the NBA want to do with basketball, start their own academies, home grow, let's say, their own talent. I mean, we're starting at the age of 12, not high school, at the age of 12.
Well, hasn't the NCAA been kind of trying to avoid this very thing? I mean, really hands off?
You're absolutely right. I mean, the whole issue of should a high school player be able to go right to the pros?
Right.
Has been on the tables, and the rules about that have changed, you know, many, many times, backwards and forwards. And there are a lot of people who argue, and I must say I've been one of them through the years, to say, just do the athletics. And one day, he's got all the money in the world. When he's 50, if he wants to go to college, he'll go to college.
Well, then how much is this potential partnership about really preparing these potential stars for the life that they are about to enter, where so many of them now come out and they literally cannot handle the money that's being thrown at them?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. It's about that, which is prepare these kids early for, you know, a life in case they don't make the big time, or in case their knee gets blown out. But it, you know what it has to do, Tess, also with? It has to do with basketball skills. At these sneaker camps, it's all about athleticism and ego. So a kid comes in and flies above the rim and everybody says, oh my God, he is the next LeBron James. Sign him up. Make him happy. Make sure he's going to my school. Make sure he loves the Lakers or whoever, because that's where he's going to be eventually. But then when it comes to teamwork and actually trying to beat, you know, a Russian team or a Romanian team or, you know, all the teams around the world, they're beating us pretty soundly in international competition.
Any drawback to this?
Well, the obvious drawback, Tess, is that it sure smacks of a direct feeder system.
Yeah.
So, you know, you see a kid at 12, 13, 14, it's similar to baseball in the Dominican Republic. When the Dodgers go down there and they identify a 14-year-old kid who's got a great arm and got great footwork, and they say, you know, hey, we're going to, you know, make your home a little bit nicer, mm-hmm. and don't ever forget Dodger Blue.
And eventually, they end up in Dodger Blue.
There you go.
All right. Our Business of Sports analyst, Diana Nyad, thanks so much for coming in. Good to see you again.
Tess, it's always my pleasure. Thank you.
Today, the United Nations' top human rights body passed a resolution condemning Israeli attacks on Gaza, saying they've created a humanitarian crisis. But it's also an economic crisis, and one that extends beyond just Gaza. Yesterday, we brought you a story about staying in business on the Israeli side of the border. Today, the other side. In the West Bank, Israeli restrictions on Palestinian trade and travel have created what the World Bank calls a shattered economic space. Marketplace's Sam Eaton traveled there to see how businesses are coping.
If you're Palestinian and you're in the export business, chances are your products don't travel very far. Since the beginning of the most recent Palestinian uprising in 2000, Israel has imposed severe restrictions on the movement of people and goods both within the West Bank and across the border. One of those borders is near Jenin in the northern agricultural region of the West Bank. Here, Palestinian middlemen sell produce by the truckload to Israeli wholesalers on the other side. Imad Zakarni says Israel is the only country he's allowed to sell to, forcing him to take whatever price the Israeli buyers offer and then pray they'll keep their word.
Here's an example of one trader who owes us about $300,000. This is a check for $14,000 that has bounced and been returned to us unpaid. We've tried contacting him repeatedly, but he doesn't return our calls.
Jenin exporters report that more than $8 million in Israeli checks have bounced so far, and Zakarni says there's little they can do about it.
There's nothing in our law that allows us to get this money. We were informed that this company has gone out of business, bankrupt. And according to Israeli law, we can only get about $2 a month out of them.
Why keep going given these conditions?
We don't have any alternatives. I'm an accountant by profession. I graduated from university in 1984, but I can't find a job. Even when there are jobs, they don't pay enough. So we keep farming and selling in the local market and trying to sell to the Israelis.
After more than 40 years of Israeli occupation, the West Bank's economy remains largely undeveloped. Roughly 90% of Palestinian exports are sold to Israel. Shipping delays and Israeli security fees make these labor-intensive, low-value goods practically worthless in the global marketplace. Businesses that rely on imported goods don't fare any better.
The Israelis have made it impossible for us to be able to do proper business.
Sam Bahor is a real estate developer based in Ramallah.
Whatever you want to do in Palestine, whatever you want to do, the Israeli closure is part of your decision making. You cannot get a screw, a nail, a hammer into Palestine if the Israelis don't want you to bring it in.
Despite the challenges, Bahor recently completed a $10 million shopping center in Ramallah. He says his crews were installing the final panels on the glass facade as Israeli F-16s bombed the city.
We definitely don't build for today. I don't build under the assumption that the occupation will exist forever. We are putting in place the seeds that will grow post-conflict.
But planting those financial seeds can be difficult. Like the flow of goods, the flow of Palestinian people in the West Bank is also tightly controlled.
We are at Ainab checkpoint, and this is the checkpoint that cuts off the Jenin area from the rest of the West Bank.
Nasser Abu Farha runs a fair trade export business in Jenin. Every time he takes a trip to Europe or the United States to meet with clients, he has to navigate the West Bank's labyrinth of more than 500 military checkpoints.
So the car has to stop until the soldier wave for them to step ahead. And they ask for our IDs.
Abu Farha is slowly making his way to Jordan, where he'll catch his flight to Europe. The journey takes an entire day. Tel Aviv's airport is only an hour and a half away, but it's off limits to Palestinians. Abu Farha says this is the bitter pill. Israel's luxury high-rises and busy ports are all visible from this road, but they're a world away. In the West Bank, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
And next week, this program will broadcast live from Dubai. You can find out more about our special, The Middle East at Work, at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, thanks to the economic stimulus plan, lots of Americans will be getting a check from Uncle Sam this spring, even people who don't normally file a tax return. But there is a catch. You can't get a refund unless you file a 2007 return. The tax man wants everybody to get what they're owed. So today the IRS announced that people who aren't legally obligated to file a tax return can use the agency's free file program to complete their information and get a rebate check. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 214 points, 1.75%. The Nasdaq lost 52 points, 2.3%. The S&P 500 dipped 23 points, 1.8%. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the program, a new commodities market boils over.
We used to try to achieve about 1,000 contracts a day in the rice market, and now we're frequently trading 2,000, 3,000 contracts per day.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.